All right, so it's been a couple months since we've been here last. I hope you remember what it is we're doing. I hope I remember what it is we're doing. Book of Revelation, if you remember, is what we're doing. A couple times ago, we talked briefly about how to approach the book and how we were going to be doing that, looking at it not necessarily as something written primarily for future telling purposes, but for ministering to God's people throughout the church age. Last time we spent a good amount of time talking about the symbolic nature of Revelation and you know, kind of digging into to symbolism and how it came to be and why it is. And although we talked a little bit about the role the Old Testament played in that, the very central role, what we're doing today is to really dive even deeper into the role of the Old Testament. I've got a lot, and this might be a little academic, a little heavy. I'll apologize now for that, if that's going to be the case. But I hope it's helpful, and I hope we're able to all gain a little something from it as we walk away. Hopefully you all have your bagels and drinks. All of us see and understand the world through a grid, right? Sometimes we're aware of the ideas that govern our understanding, at least in part. Other times we're not. Things like myths, stories, other ideas about the nature of the world, the nature of ourselves, even our very language, all of these things shape our worldview, how we understand one. And everyone has one, right? They are universal. Worldviews are universal. Some are just more thought through and consistent than others. The Apostle John is no exception, and I think we can say that the chief contributor to his worldview is what he knew as the Hebrew Bible, which we now call the Old Testament. And the fact of this both helps us and hinders us as we approach the book of Revelation. There's a general acknowledgement among scholars that the book of Revelation contains more Old Testament references than any other New Testament book. Though counting them is problematic because how the Old Testament concepts formed the basis of John's worldview is complex. How do we know if there is a direct reference to the Old Testament? Or maybe is it indirect? Or is it a categorical influence? And why does it matter? Why does it matter? If John is drawing purposefully, consciously from the Old Testament, that gives us something to work with to arrive at how to understand Revelation. The author's intent drives the meaning of the text. And if we can see that John is very clearly alluding to the Old Testament, then we need to dig into the Old Testament to understand what he's doing. If we're to understand Revelation correctly, we have to grasp John's intention. So Revelation probably took its form as a result of the visions that John had that he was shown. Then, you know, at some point he sat down, probably alone, maybe with others, to help record these things and put them on paper. And the references to the Old Testament and its various versions were the combination, really, of the recording of the actual visions, his experience as it happened, which would have been influenced by John's traditions and how he thought of things, as well as subsequent reflection on the Old Testament during the writing down of these visions. No doubt, John would have associated some of his visions and what he heard with similar Old Testament passages. He would have used the language of those passages to describe what he saw and heard. And though this might not be really clear or obvious to us in our day, in our setting, it actually would have made Revelation easier to understand to its first readers. But it gives us some work to do. The range of the Old Testament used in reference in some way in Revelation includes the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of Moses, the book of Judges, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Job, and the major and minor prophets. Roughly half the references are from Psalms, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, with Daniel yielding the most. So if you want to focus in on Old Testament research to help you understand Revelation, Ezekiel and Daniel are a good place to start. Among the allusions to Daniel, the greatest number are from Daniel chapter 7. So I think this is actually worth looking at in some depth here, even though it's not Revelation per se. So if you have your Bibles, open up to Daniel 7, and let's just get a sense of what's in this chapter. I don't think I'm going to read it all, but if you're familiar with Revelation or read it recently, you should remark on how familiar a lot of this will stand. So this is Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, the wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? How about this next part? "As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened." And it goes on. "I saw in the night visions," I'll jump down to 13. "Behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all these things. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest. It's exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom." And he goes on after this to talk about the fourth beast some more. Clearly, this is important for understanding Revelation, because it's so familiar. And though we might tend to put the cart before the horse, this is what formed how John understood what he saw. This is what John was thinking of when he was trying to communicate the visions and the things that he heard to his readers. And we have to be familiar with it, because almost, you know, a very high number of these things are literally lifted right out and used by John and applied to what he was saying. So Daniel, very important, especially Daniel chapter 7. Ezekiel ranks as the second most used Old Testament book and probably exerts at least as much influence as Daniel overall. But from beginning to end, the Old Testament in general plays such a major role that a proper understanding of its use is necessary for us to understand Revelation as a whole. But we need to spend a little bit of time here, and what we're going to do today is thinking about the nature of the Old Testament references. The idea being, hopefully we can kind of know how to approach different parts in different ways and make sense of them. There are no formal quotations. Most references are really allusions more than direct reference. That can make identifying difficult. Adding to the difficulty that John seems to draw on both the Hebrew and Greek biblical sources, and he often modifies both of those. So because of the difficulties involved, it can be helpful to categorize the way John uses the Old Testament in a couple ways. First of all, there's a clear allusion. These are easy. The wording is almost identical to the Old Testament source. It shares a common core meaning and really could not have come from anywhere else. Not too many of those, though, but they're nice. Then there's a probable allusion. So though the wording is not as close, it still contains an idea or wording that is uniquely traceable to the Old Testament, or exhibits a structure of ideas that's uniquely traceable to an Old Testament passage. So that's a probable allusion. And then at the bottom, we have a possible allusion where the language is only generically similar to the source. Maybe there's a little echo of a word or a concept. So this non-formal character of the Old Testament references that make it difficult not only for us to identify these allusions, but determine whether an allusion was made consciously or not. And the difficulty is compounded because many, if not most, of these references are combined in groups. So if you look at the descriptions of Christ in chapter 1, for example, or the throne room of God in chapter 4, the beast in chapter 13, these taking images and bits and pieces from here and there across the Old Testament and combining them into one. So the less intentional the allusions are, the more they're likely just based on John's worldview or way of thinking, on a mind and memory that's so saturated with Old Testament language and ideas that they unconsciously made their way into the book. In this case, it doesn't do us a whole lot of benefit to dive deep into the Old Testament context because they're not consciously there. They're just less intentional. But if John consciously used these elusive combinations for their evocative and emotional power, as some claim, less to make a specific idea point, but to make an emotional point, then it's also kind of unnecessary to go into each reference's own context to understand it, because the point isn't in the reference, it's in the power of the group together. Folks wonder why Revelation is hard, right? It is hard. There's a lot going on here. But I would say, and the whole reason we're having this conversation today, is that often a greater understanding of the book is gained. The greater understanding of Revelation is gained, and it's a motive effect felt when the various elusive parts are studied in their Old Testament context. It's worthwhile taking the deep dive. It's worth it to get the work done to seek to understand the Old Testament better. For example, if you have your Bible, flip over to Revelation chapter 4. So Revelation chapter 4, verses 2 through 9, is likely an unconscious mixing of Old Testament allusions, but they're all from descriptions of theophanies that function as introductory sections to announcements of judgment. So let me read this. Revelation 4, 2 through 9. At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven. That sounds familiar. We just read something about that. With one seated on the throne. And he who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. And around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. Round the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the throne were 24 elders, clothed in white garments with golden crowns on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder. And before the throne were burning seven torches of fire, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature is like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle in flight. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within. And day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. So, let's do a little comparison, shall we? 4:2. Keep one finger there and flip over to the book of Isaiah. In fact, for me, it'll be easier for me to use my iPad to do this. Isaiah 6:1. That'd be easier, but I'm actually going slower. Technology, love it. So, what we just read in 4:2, once I was in the Spirit, and behold, the throne stood in heaven, the one seated on the throne, Isaiah 6:1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And he goes on to talk about the seraphim that were there, and look what they say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts." 1 Kings 22 is also similar. 1 Kings 22:9. Then the king of Israel summoned an officer. Oops, that's not it. Maybe I wrote that reference down wrong. 22:19, how about that? Micaiah said, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall?' Announcement of judgment is coming." Revelation 4:3, "He who sat there on had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and round the throne was a rainbow." Compare that to Ezekiel 1:28. "Like the appearance of a bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so is the appearance of the brightness all around." We could go on to look at verse 5 compared to Ezekiel 1:13 or Exodus 19:16. We could look at verse 6 and compare it to Ezekiel 1:22. But the point is made that in these Old Testament pictures of theophanies, visions of God, that function as introductory sections to announcement of judgment, we have almost the exact same pattern and the exact same descriptions of what's going on there. Clearly, John is drawing our attention back to that. This is clearly intentional. John's doing something here purposefully to help us understand what's coming. The same visions that formed these announcements of impending judgment then are being used to do the same thing now. And all of these common scenes and themes of the Old Testament context, they all intensify the cognitive and emotive aspects of the picture. So folks that are quick to say that, you know, John is just operating off his memory or not specifically using the Old Testament is really ought to take some caution, because these things seem pretty clear. John identified himself, after all, with a long line of Old Testament visionaries. He was conscious of developing the ideas of the earlier prophets. So we can confidently say that the clear Old Testament references are, in fact, the result of intentional activity. You can look at chapter 1, chapters 4, 17, 21, throughout Revelation. All of these things are clear connections. But as soon as we say it's clear, John's intentionality is ripe with liberty. A lot of people say he's very creative in the way he uses the Old Testament. And therefore, biblical scholars conclude that he handles numerous passages without consideration of their original context at all. Really, what they're saying is that he mishandles the Old Testament. What are we to say to that? Well, they'll say that, John doesn't use quotation formulas when introducing the Old Testament. So he must be using them just as a cloak for his own new thoughts that are unrelated to the Old Testament context. But informal citation, just because you don't use quotes, doesn't logically entail non-contextual use or that John made no attempt to interpret the Old Testament. Another criticism will be, well, the readers of Revelation initially were illiterate, or they were from pagan backgrounds, or both. They wouldn't have been able to understand the interpretive use of the Old Testament. Why would John do that? Well, the churches in Asia Minor, for example, that John writes to in the beginning of Revelation, were composed of a core of Jewish believers, Jewish converts, right? And they also had Gentile God-fearers. Gentile God-fearers were the ones that, though they never converted to Judaism, were still in some way associated with the synagogues of the day. The Christians in Smyrna and Philadelphia still have some relation to the synagogue. We read that in Revelation itself. And it seems that the evangelism in Philadelphia was based to a significant degree on the Old Testament and its fulfillment in Jesus. There are specific references to a false prophet with an Old Testament name, Jezebel, in Thyatira. This suggests the teaching that the church distorted both the Old Testament and New Testament tradition. If John knew his readers would have no clue what he was talking about, why would he use so many powerful Old Testament allusions? It just doesn't make sense. He used them because they did know them, and they helped John make his point. We know from Acts and elsewhere that Jewish and Gentile believers were trained in their new faith on the basis of the Old Testament, which was, after all, the Bible of the early church. And since the book of Revelation, the individual letters were read repeatedly in the churches, it's likely that the audiences would discern more allusions on subsequent readings than from the first. And it is generally acknowledged among scholars that the majority of both pagan Greeks and Jews in the Greco-Roman world of that time learned to read in childhood. And this extended even to various degrees to slaves, so they were not illiterate. But it is still difficult to know when there's conscious use or unconscious use of the Old Testament. And non-contextual use can be expected if the use is unconscious. But the whole concept of context deserves a little bit of thought as well. What does it mean to take a verse in context? Well, what's usually meant is literary context, which is how a passage functions in the logical flow of the argument that's being made there and throughout the book. That's typically what we mean to take something in or out of context. But there's also historical context. For example, if you look at the book of Hosea, or the use of Hosea in Revelation, the historical context of Hosea 1:11 is the Exodus. So the way it's used isn't in reference to the context of the argument of Hosea, but it's made with a historical context of the Exodus. There's also thematic context. A New Testament writer might focus on a general Old Testament theme like judgment or restoration, and then appeal to a number of specific passages from across the Old Testament that pertain to that theme. So John appears to display varying degrees of awareness of the literary context, depending on what he's using, and thematic context, and maybe even historical context, though appeal to literary and thematic context is predominant. So those texts with a low degree of correspondence with the Old Testament literary context can be considered semi-contextual. I think we need to hesitate to say non-contextual. But these ones that are semi-contextual are not clearly used in what we would consider the literary context. Even those can be broken up in a number of ways. Told you we're going a little deep here. Typically, we'll see the first category of these semi-contextual uses are Old Testament segments as literary prototypes. Okay, in this case, John takes over Old Testament context or sequences as models after which to pattern his own creative compositions. It's been argued, I think, successfully that broad patterns from Daniel, we saw chapter 2 last time we talked a little about, and we just looked at chapter 7, that those broad patterns have been followed in Revelation 1, 4 and 5, 13 and 17. Suggestions also made that the influence of Daniel may even extend to the structure of the whole book. Allusions to Daniel chapter 2, 28 and 29, we looked at this one last time, happen to punctuate the book at major divisional transitions. So 1:1, 1:19, 4:1, 22:6 all reference this one passage out of Daniel. Seems to have a lot of influence. In a somewhat similar vein, broad portions of Ezekiel seem to have been dominant influence on at least 11 major sections of Revelation. Chapter 4, chapter 5, 6, 7, 8, 14, 17, 18, 20, 21. These uses are placed to a marked extent in the same order even in Revelation that they are in Ezekiel. It follows the same flow, same order. One scholar went so far as to say that John used Ezekiel as the model for the book's overall structure, so that it is literally the key to understanding the message of the book altogether. Might be overstating a little bit, but the point's made. It's important. Also, there's a consensus among scholars that the plagues of the trumpets in Revelation 8, 6 through 12, and those of the bowls in 16, 1 through 9, follow the paradigm of the Exodus plagues and trials, although they are somewhat creatively reworked and applied. When Old Testament texts are alluded to in this way as models, they really seem to exist for two purposes. One, the Old Testament patterns appear to be used as forms through which future eschatological fulfillment is understood and predicted. You can look at chapters 13 and 17. But they're also used as lenses through which the past and present eschatological fulfillment is understood, like in chapters 1 and 4 and 5. So that's the Old Testament model use, non-contextual, right? Or semi-contextual. There's also thematic uses. So in addition to alluding to specific Old Testament texts, John develops Old Testament themes. Such themes include end-time judgment, salvation, the abomination of desolation from Daniel, the divine warrior, earthquake, holy war, day of the Lord. All of these things are themes that John builds upon. And interestingly, the function of hymns in Revelation is also based on their use of in the Old Testament. The series of hymns in Revelation, which are found in 4:11, 5:13, 7, 9 through 12, 11, 15 through 18, and 19, 1 through 8, they have the same function as hymns in Isaiah chapters 40 through 55. They end subsections, they round them off. They not only offer a concluding thanksgiving, but they also give a bit of an interpretive summary of the theme as a whole in that whole previous section. So use of hymns can be considered an Old Testament theme, but also an interpretive aid. They help us understand. That's thematic use. There's also analogical uses. And an analogy in general can probably be considered the most general description of the Old Testament usage in Revelation, since the very act of referring to an Old Testament text is to place it in some comparative relationship with something in the New Testament. We're concerned here with specific well-known persons, places, events. Even though John might handle these things with some degree of creative freedom, they almost always broadly retain an essential Old Testament association, and they convey principles of continuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament. A key idea in the Old Testament context is carried over as the main characteristic or principle to be applied in the New Testament situation. A few examples of this. Judgment. Theophanies introducing judgment can be found in Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1, Daniel 7, and are used by John in Revelation 4 to 5 for the same purposes. Concept of the books of judgment, opening the books, found in Ezekiel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 12. Those are used in Revelation 5, 1 through 5. And Ezekiel 2 is used in Revelation 10. Horsemen as divine agents of judgment, found in Zechariah chapter 1 or chapter 6. Well, they're used in Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Locusts as agents of judgment from Joel 1 and 2 are used in Revelation 9, 7 through 10. The idea that Babylon was judged by God in 1 hour from Daniel chapter 4, verse 17 is used in Revelation 18 in various places. Those are all themes around judgment. How about around tribulation and persecution of God's people? Well, we have 10 days of tribulation talked about in Daniel chapter 1, verse 12. That's used in Revelation 2, verse 10. We have 3.5 years of tribulation mentioned in Daniel 7 and Daniel 12 that's used in Revelation 11, 12, and 13. Persecuting rulers that are symbolized as beasts. Well, we just read about that in Daniel chapter 7. That's used in Revelation 11 through 13, 17. Babylon the Great, of course, Daniel 4, 30, used all over the place in Revelation, chapter 14, chapter 16, 17, 18. It's also the concept of seductive or idolatrous teaching, like what we had from Balaam in Numbers 25 and 31, referenced in Revelation 2, or Jezebel from 1 Kings 16, or 2 Kings 9, used in Revelation chapter 2. Divine protection is another topic, another analogy. The tree of life from Genesis 2:9 is used in Revelation 2:22. The idea of the Israelites being sealed from Ezekiel 9 is used in Revelation 7. Idea or the concept of the wings of an eagle we see from Exodus chapter 19 is and Deuteronomy 21 is used in Revelation 12. There's a lot of them. There's another way the Old Testament is used semi-contextually, which is for universalization. So this is where John applies to the world what the Old Testament applied only to Israel or to other entities. He expands the scope, if you will. So Exodus 19:6, we hear about the kingdom of priests, is then turned to apply to the church in Revelation 1 and 5. Exodus plague imagery from Egypt is applied to the whole earth in Revelation 8 and 16. 8, 9, a third of the sea, including fish and ships, are impacted versus the river and its fish in the Exodus. 16:10, rather than the sun being darkened, the kingdom of the satanic beast becomes darkened. All of these types of examples of universalization are harmonious developments of the Old Testament principles, though. A prime example is the case of the Old Testament texts that pertain to ethnic Israel's redemption and applied in Revelation to the world's redemption on the basis of defining the true people of God according to their faith in Christ and on their corporate representation in Christ, the one who sums up true Israel in himself. Thus, the church comes to be viewed as the true Israel. Then there's the case of inverted use of the Old Testament. These are allusions that are on the surface distinctly contradictory to their Old Testament meanings. Often, though, such inverted uses are a conscious attempt by John to express irony. Clearest example of this is Revelation 3:9. This refers to the Asianic prophecies that the Gentiles will come and bow down before Israel and recognize Israel as God's chosen people. That's in Isaiah. In Revelation, the hope is now turned upside down as it's the Jewish persecutors of the Christians whom God will make submit to the church. Ironic inverted use. Other such examples should really alert us to caution in making brash statements about non-contextual use. Just because these passages invert the Old Testament context does not mean they disregard it. Then there's stylistic use of the Old Testament. This is the most general category, including a multitude of grammatical issues and solecisms, which are interesting little errors of grammar found throughout Revelation. Why did John write stylistically like an Old Testament author or an Old Testament prophet? Well, his purpose was deliberately to create a biblical effect in its hearer. He wanted to demonstrate a solidarity of his work with that of the Old Testament. John realized he was a prophet. He realized the message that he was bringing to God's people was akin to the message of the Old Testament prophets. And he wanted to make it crystal clear that folks understood this. One more note about Old Testament usage, and this is a note about numbers. Commentators usually agree that at least four numbers, 3, 4, 7, and 12, and their multiples, have symbolic or figurative meanings in Revelation that receive their significance from the Old Testament. We could have talked about this last time, but I think it belongs better here. 7 is a number of completeness, as apparent from the 7 days of creation, which is the complete period of God's work of creating. Likewise, the Hebrew notion of a full week being 7 days enhanced the association of seven with completeness. The Old Testament uses seven repeatedly for the figurative notion of completeness, sevenfold wrath in Genesis 4, 24, Psalm 79. This is best understood as a figurative indication of a full or complete wrath to satisfy justice. Completeness. Four is also a number of completeness, especially connoting something of universal or worldwide scope. 12, completeness again, as well as the accompanying idea of unity and diversity, as in the one nation of Israel composed of 12 tribes. Other example of completeness, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls. They're so numbered in order to underscore the completeness of God's worldwide judgment. Many people see a sevenfold division in the book's structure, which indicates the completeness of the book's message about judgment and salvation. And there's a broader fourfold structure of the book, design of the book, that underscores the same thing, with the added notion that the message has absolute universal application. That the book is only addressed to seven churches in chapters 2 and 3 suggests that these churches represent the church universal. 4, 7, 12 also figuratively convey the notion of God's ordering of the world and his sovereignty over it. The numbers point to the reality that God's will guides every event. For example, the proliferation of repeated series of sevens, especially the letters, the seals, the trumpets, the bowls, together with formerly unnumbered segments with seven discernible divisions, these all form the essential structure of the book and reveal a really thoroughgoing and careful arrangement on John's behalf. Each sevenfold segment narrates the battle of evil forces against God and his people and concludes with the defeat of the enemy and God's victory. One overall figurative effect of this repeated complex patterning is that the reader is left with the impression of God's all-encompassing will being like an elaborate spider web in which Satan and his forces are caught. Though they attempt to free themselves from divine sovereignty, they cannot escape ultimate defeat. The repetition of the numbers, the repeated series of numbers, they highlight the idea that nothing is haphazard or accidental. But it's very kind of foreign to us to think in those terms, yet it wasn't so then. So, to conclude, what do we take away from this? Perhaps one reason for the high degree of Old Testament influence in Revelation is that John could think of no better way to describe some of his visions than with language used by the Old Testament prophets to describe similar visions. It really is that direct. And it's not too much to say that familiarity with the Old Testament and with the spirit that lives in the Old Testament is a most essential condition for a fruitful reading of Revelation. You just can't make sense of Revelation faithfully to what John wanted to do without it. The conclusion of this overview is that the place of the Old Testament in the formation of thought and revelation is both a servant and a guide. For John, the Christ event is the key to understanding the Old Testament. And yet reflection on the Old Testament context leads the way to a further comprehension of this event, and it provides the redemptive historical background against which the apocalyptic visions are better understood. So in Revelation, as elsewhere in the New Testament, the New Testament interprets the Old, and the Old interprets the New. I know that was a lot, and I don't have any more for you, so be thankful. I will remind you that if you have questions, we are dedicating most of the last session to reviewing questions and going over them and discussing them. So write them down, hand them to me, email them to me, whatever, and we'll deal with them on the last time. I don't have any yet, by the way. Sorry, last time might be really short, so I encourage you, give me questions. Thanks. Have a good day.